VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. It's the morning after the night before, as young English hearts are broken and Italy win their first European Championship since 1968. We'll also look at our favourite moments from the game, Euro 2020. I'm Hugh Woozencroft, and joining me today, Alison Rudd, Gregor Robertson and Tom Clark. How are you all?
Upset.
Gutted. Absolutely gutted, Hugh. I'm sure you are as well.
It's a weird feeling. Like, I went to the final and I was just like, whatever happens, I'm so proud that we got to a final. I'm at Wembley Stadium. You know, I'm from Wembley, watching England, you know, in a major tournament final. This is an experience that I'm just going to hold on to. It doesn't matter what the result is, because I might never see this again. And I still really feel that way. And I didn't feel desperately hurt about the penalties. I know loads of people did. You had, of course, we'll talk about it, the moment where you felt like it was going to be destiny almost. But I when that first goal went in from Luke Shaw, it was worth every penny, basically. It was a priceless moment. I mean, you literally felt on top of the world, and we were all looking at each other just like, oh my God, is this really happening? And a few people that I spoke to that went to the game as well felt exactly the same. You know, when the ball hit the back of the net 2 minutes in, the atmosphere, the reaction, you know, that sense of togetherness, it was incredible, really. So it was worth every penny just for that moment. And I think I would have felt more bitterly dejected had I felt England deserved to win and lost on penalties. But we'll talk about it in a while. I think it was credit to Italy that they won the tournament, and I think that they were deserved winners in the end. So, you know, you leave the stadium and you think, that was a huge missed opportunity. You know, we might never get that chance again. That was really my feeling. But in football terms, you know, I applauded the Italians when they came round, because I think they were fitting winners. And I applauded the England team because I felt like they gave us a brilliant summer and were, you know, deserving finalists. And this morning, yeah, I mean, it still hasn't really sunk in. It still feels really weird that I even went to watch England in a major final. So the sadness hasn't hit me yet. You know, the gutted feeling hasn't hit me yet, because I still felt, for me, yesterday was about the experience of going to the game. And yeah, I got to do it. So yeah, I feel pretty good about that. So yeah. But look, it was an excellent summer of football generally. It ended in glory for Italy. Penalty heartbreak for England. We all know the story. 1-1 in normal time, 3-2 to Italy on penalties at Wembley. But I wanted to know from you guys what your overriding emotions are. Same as me, what I've just reflected on, really. Alison, I'll start with you.
I'm in a bit of a mess, because rather peculiarly, I dreamt in great detail last night that the England under 21 team had earlier in the day won a penalty shootout and won a tournament. It was a very realistic dream. And when I woke up, I thought that England had won last night, because it was such a detailed dream. And then I had to readjust and realise that that was a dream, and actually England had lost the penalty shootout. So that when I have those realistic dreams that impinge on your reality, it does actually ruin my morning. So yeah, so I actually can speak for everyone and say I know what it feels like when England do win a penalty shootout. It's just not actually real. So that's the shame of it. I feel more should be made of the fact. I'm interested, Hugh, that you said how beautiful the moment was when Luke Shaw scored, because Didn't anyone think the whole thing was such a parallel with the World Cup in Russia? That England start well, and then slowly what you see is we lack technical ability in midfield, and that's the thing we're supposed to be able to sort out. I'm not saying Gareth Southgate should pluck out of a hat like a rabbit an amazingly gifted midfielder, a Pirlo type, as we keep saying. We don't have one. So his tactics have to be to get around the fact. So you play counter-attacking football, you use your pace. But instead, England tired. And that comes down to, I think, an inability to know how to plan for the fact that you must know that Italy are going to slowly look more classy as they get on and start running rings around you and outthinking you and using the ball better. And if they use the ball better, that makes you tired. So it's not just about substitutes with relation to who takes penalties. It's about substitutes, fresh legs, planning it out properly. And in that sense, I don't think we've progressed very much at all from the Russia World Cup, I'm sad to say.
Tom, what about you? Overriding emotions.
It is gutted, really, Hugh, I think, to be honest. And I think in the office last night with all the other guys on the Times Sports desk, we were watching the game and had similar feelings to Alison, really. You know, you're watching it in quite an analytical way, and obviously also you're planning how you're going to project the story. And in extra time, a few of us, myself, James Restall and others, were saying, you know, it'd almost be not better, but you kind of wanted Italy to score in extra time because they were the better team overall. I think if we're being dispassionate, they were the better team. And so you were kind of going, not penalties, just not penalties, not for this team, not for this young team who we admire so much. So yeah, gutted. And when the penalties came around, a few of us said, just not the young lads, please not the young lads. And of course, that is how it panned out. So Alison's right to pick up on several of those points there. But if you ask me how I'm feeling, it is just gutted for some of those young players that it ended like that. Whilst also dispassionately probably assessing it and agreeing with Alison that Italy were the better team and that it was quite similar to that Croatia semi-final, England starting well but fading away.
Gregor, keep up the England versus Scotland theme and tell us you're delighted.
No, I'm definitely not delighted. To be brutally honest, I was a little bit conflicted watching the game because I've said all along, I've really enjoyed watching this England team. I've felt a bit of an affinity to the more than I ever have in the past. But Italy are the best team in the tournament. I think we saw that as the game wore on. And I'm also really pleased to see the best team win. That doesn't always happen. I think that's, we could all agree that Italy were the most entertaining team to watch. And the kind of most complete team, really. So I don't know. England, it would be easy now. There's going to be a kind of post-mortem in the way that England do very well and kind of almost a seeking of scapegoats. I think it would just be great if you could kind of, you know, everything Alison said there, I kind of agree with. But at the same time, Gareth Southgate's caution and his sort of flexibility got you to your first final in 55 years and you came within a penalty kick or two of lifting the trophy. So, well, I kind of agree with that. I think, you know, could he have been a little bit bolder? Could he have been a little bit braver? Do England actually have, you know, yeah, maybe midfield is one area, but do England not really have the players that could have taken on Italy a little bit more? I think they probably do. But again, I've got to come back to that. Gareth Southgate took you, the way he did it, took you to their first final in 55 years. And I think you should be very, very proud of that. There are things off the pitch that you shouldn't be proud of. Yesterday, I can't believe that a day of national sort of euphoria was turned into one of, not disgrace, but ignominy. And I'm sure we'll come to that. But on the pitch, I don't think you should be looking for anyone to blame or looking for anything other than feeling pride in what England have done this summer.
Before we get to the game itself, how did you all watch and experience the final? Because like I say, I'm never going to forget it, but I was inside Wembley Stadium. Did you do anything special? Alison?
No.
Well, I mean, listen, hold on a minute. A person who decorated their house in dozens of flags during the last month is telling me that I'm asking a ridiculous question by asking if they did anything special for a final with England in. I mean, it's not that difficult a question.
No, I watched it I watched it mainly with a work hat on, actually. I'm either working or I'm not working. Hugh, she said, digging a bit. I'm working or I'm not working. And I didn't want to be in a place where it was so loud I couldn't, you know, hear my own thoughts or whatever. I wanted to watch it in a analytical football-y way as opposed to a nutty beer-throwing way. So not special. No.
I was in the office, Hugh, working very, very hard, of course. But it's always a unique experience watching, particularly an England game, particularly a knockout game. I've had some great, great memories watching it with colleagues in the office. The Colombia penalty shootout was one of my favourites. And as I said, it's unique because you have these moments of where you hear people shout, switch it wide, switch it wide. And then you have someone else shouting, have we finished that Djokovic headline? Hurry up, come on, we need to finish that. So it's a very strange experience, but I mean, the penalty shootout, it was just really tough to watch. Everyone kind of crowded around one screen because that was the screen with the fastest flow of the coverage. And we realized that that person was ahead of everyone else. So everyone's crowded around one small screen rather than watching on the big tellies, which are about 2 seconds behind. So, that was a unique experience. I may have shouted, Jordan effing Pickford, you effing legend, when he saved that Jorginho penalty. I know I've been a big Pickford fan, but what Pickford a penalty club, save. Yeah. What a penalty save for him to do that. And I was willing us to score the next one. So, it's always a unique experience watching in the office with colleagues. Because then you can't really digest and process what's happened afterwards. Because Saka misses that penalty and it's like, right, publish headlines, pictures, let's go. We've got about 10 minutes to do all this stuff now. So as I say, that's probably where my gutted feeling comes from waking up this morning.
What about you, Gregor? Nipper on your lap, giving it, soaking up the Wembley experience.
I think you know the answer to that one. I've got a 7-week-old child. There's one game I left the house for in this entire tournament, which was Scotland versus England. The listeners may or may not have discerned that in my voice. I'll leave that up to you to decide. But it has been a tournament like no other for me in that sense. But look, at the same time, I'm not sure I would really want it to be out in the kind of, I agree with Alison, in the kind of beer flying everywhere, particularly because I was a neutral, essentially. I wanted you guys, I would have been delighted for England to win, but I'm not sure I could have stood being in the box park or something.
Where I was yesterday, yeah, surrounded by former England internationals, Colleen Rooney and the like. Not that she played for England. I mean, she was in there as well, that's all I'm saying. Let's get to the game then. Let's get to the action itself. I wanted to talk about Italy first because firstly they won, but also I think they did some pretty interesting things tactically that basically, you know, I think might have got them over the line in such a tight game. Of course, it went to penalties, but I think, you know, they were able to keep England at arm's length for big periods because of the tactical changes. Gregor, so I'll start with you on this one. What do you think the key to Italy's win was?
I think kind of trust in their game plan, really. Because England, I know we'll come to England. England were outstanding for the first half an hour, and we'll talk about that more after. But it really took until about 55 minutes, an hour, until Italy had really, really started to impose their kind of... And as Alison said, it does kind of come back to that midfield area where they're just kind of the number of passes and they're moving England around and England just continually retreating. It was, as I said before, it was going to be a game of very fine margins, and they got the equaliser with a set piece and they won on penalties. But I think Italy's dominance with the ball, it comes down to the fact that they had 65% possession over the course of the game, 65% possession over the course of the game. And it was almost, I was watching almost thinking, this is a bit like watching England v Denmark in reverse. Denmark were England. You know, they had some periods of the game where they were in the ascendancy, but as the game wore on, the better team grew into the game and became superior, and the weight of pressure, you just felt it was going to result in a goal and possibly a winner. And England got a stroke of luck to get their winner against Denmark. Italy, they came close, but England deserved, England defended really well as well. So I just think that superiority, a kind of bravery on the ball was the real difference. And we'll come to talk about England and why they didn't, why they don't play like that later. But I think really that was the difference between the teams.
Well, I just think it's interesting that Gregor mentioned the 55th minute to the 60th minute as the moment when Italy kind of really started to assert their dominance, because that was when Mancini made his first two changes, taking off Immobile for Berardi and Barella for Cristante. And that change up top, I think, was quite interesting because he went from having a kind of central striker in Immobile to pushing Insigne and Berardi, two wide players, into kind of two, you know, almost a bit like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer does sometimes, with two quick, nippy, skillful players playing up front, moved Chiesa out wide, and it suddenly was causing England all sorts of problems because the defenders didn't have a figurehead in Immobile to kind of go and go, right, I've got him, I'm going to clean him out. Immobile did very, very little as a central striker for all the game. I think Stones and Maguire did a really good job on him until then. And I think that change was big as well. And as Gregor said, the bravery as well. Chiellini and Bonucci at certain points were on the edge of the box. I couldn't believe it, the way they were kind of pushing forward. And there was a moment where I think it was just early on in the second half where Chiellini ended up almost on the edge of the box, offering to play a 1-2 with Jorginho. And you just thought, they are so in control here and they are just pushing further, harder and harder on England's net here, and they're going to have to, they might have to give at some point. So I just thought it was really interesting that Gregor picked that out, because that felt like the key change from Mancini to me.
Alison, what do you think went wrong for England with, you know, this period of dominance in the second half that Italy had that I think just wore them out?
Well, if you're getting tired, you make subs. There's a chance you can make six in the game, so you can be a bit more, have a bit more lateral thinking. Basically, I think through the tournament, overall, teams that have done well or surprised us are the ones that have embraced the subs. And you end up thinking, how many have they made? Have they made eight? Have they made nine? Because they've been that impactful. Whereas with England, it's been consistently, yes, I know they got to the final and you shouldn't be too critical of that fact, but it's been consistently a case of, does he not know how many subs he can make? And it's either the fans demanding someone exciting to come on the pitch, or you're just looking at it and thinking they're being slow to adapt to the opposition's energy, or the team themselves are tiring and the changes seem to be slow. So I'm not quite sure what the point of having so many fit, young, attacking players on the bench is if you're going to treat them like they're some sort of rare commodity. They're part of it. This is the new football. This is pandemic football. You have thousands of substitutions and you can change your team. You can change everything about your team if you think it through. And I'm not talking about being reactive purely to what's happening. I'm talking about having a plan of action, knowing that things aren't going to be static and you have to adapt and move and try and stay one step ahead if possible. So I sort of didn't feel there was a good plan for how to keep the energy going, because if you're a counter-attacking team, your basic philosophy is, if we don't concede, we'll probably be okay. That requires a lot of energy and effort. And I just felt England ran out of steam and ran out of ideas. You can't criticise them for not having the technical ability, because I don't think it was there for Southgate to pick in the first place.
Just picking up on a few of those points Alison's made, it's worth remembering in defence of Gareth Southgate that the no real subs policy was one we were praising in the Denmark game. And that's in relation to what Gregor said about this being the inverse match. I think I was saying that Denmark made a lot of subs in that match and it seemed to unravel for them. And England only made one or two changes and that seemed to work as they continued to dominate. That was the other similarity in this game. I actually think England, they briefly got a foothold back in the game when they made a few changes. I think Henderson came on and they switched to a back four that seemed to slightly calm things down. But I actually felt overall that it slightly unraveled for England as they made more and more substitutions, which does lead back to Alison's point that you have to have a better plan. It can't just be, let's throw on these talented lads. There has to be a clearer plan with what to do with them. I mean, to me, one of the most interesting subs was Declan Rice going off, because I thought in the first half he was absolutely unbelievable. The guy looked like a world-class defensive midfielder. And so when I saw him going off, obviously Jordan Henderson is an incredibly experienced player, but one that's not fully fit and hadn't had loads of minutes at this tournament.
He didn't look fit, did he? He didn't look fit last night.
He didn't look fit. And it felt like he was being thrown on as the player that he is, an experienced player. And I made a joke in the office. I was like, oh, here comes Jordan shouting, come on, come on, come on, all of them. But kind of that really felt like all it was doing. And when you compare that to what Rice was giving England in the first half, breaking up the play, pinching the ball, making bombastic runs forward, barging people out of the way, that was another turning point in terms of substitutions. On the flip side to the Mancini changes, which had a positive impact, I just felt England's were a bit confused and it unravelled a little bit.
I remember the one point, it may have been towards the end of the 90 minutes, it may have been in extra time, looking at the front three and thinking, you know, it was Kane, Sterling, Mount, and then even when Saka came on, and thinking, who's he going to take off here for Grealish? Because Grealish is not, he doesn't seem as a solid citizen like those guys. And ultimately, his fear of losing, of conceding a losing goal, was greater than his, you know, his desire to find a winner. That has underpinned every single decision Gareth Southgate has made in this tournament. And I'd say it again, you can criticise him for that. It got you to the final and within penalty kicks. But if everyone's screaming for Jack Grealish, he doesn't see them in that light. If you think, he doesn't think, I'll throw him on to get a winner. He thinks, if I throw him on, is he going to be the solid citizen I need so that we're solid, even pressing from the front or, you know, defensively? And I think that really defines the tournament for England.
Listen, I think Roberto Mancini and Gareth Southgate was the difference in the result, to be perfectly honest. I know it finished 1-1 after extra time, so I'm not going to hammer Gareth Southgate too much, but we all know that there was that period of dominance in the second half, and it was almost like Gareth Southgate waited for the goal to go in. I mean, the pressure was there, a goal was coming, and then he makes the change of formation after he's conceded. And it was, you know, I've spoken to you guys throughout the tournament about the managers that have done best being the ones that change the game, and they proactively do that with their changes early. They don't wait for things to happen to them. And I think we've always seen Gareth Southgate being on the other side of that, you know, very, very reactive and usually too late. And that's what we saw, as Alison pointed out, in the World Cup in 2018. I think it cost us then. But I think it was brilliant from Mancini that he put Cristante on, as you mentioned, Tom. Berardi, Bernardeschi, I mean, they were choking Phillips and Rice for a period. You know, it was basically 5-on-2 in the middle of the park. Calvin Phillips, shift of his life yesterday, did brilliantly well. Declan Rice ran himself into the ground, but the manager has to notice that. He should have noticed it in 2018 when it was Jordan Henderson being run into the ground by Modric and Brozovic and Rakitic. He learned nothing, it seemed, from that game in 2018. But it was brilliant for Mancini to do it, because the wingbacks, he was having no joy down the flank, so decided to play virtually exclusively down the middle of the pitch, overloaded the middle of the park, overloaded our central midfielders, and we couldn't touch the ball. But he just wanted Gareth Southgate to react to that. And we mentioned other managers before. We mentioned the Denmark manager, Kasper Hjulmand, about having a plan B and a plan C. You know, the difference in the Denmark game when they made five changes is that the quality on their bench made the five changes made their team worse. And I don't think England's bench is that poor that if we made five changes, that the level would have dropped significantly. I just think they needed a plan B and they didn't have the plan B. It basically went to a 4-1-4-1. Jordan Henderson came on and was asked to press, and he was running into their back four. And it was like, why have you not, if you wanted a player to do that, why didn't you bring on Bellingham? Why isn't Henderson sitting and doing the job that Declan Rice was doing really well? And it was a major part of the fact that we were still in the game. So I really didn't get the changes. I actually thought Kane and Sterling were going to come off in extra time. When I saw Rashford and Sancho warming up, I thought, for ages, by the way, they were standing there since the first half in extra time. So we thought they were going to come on at the end of the first half in extra time. And Gareth Southgate left them there until there was 90 seconds left, put Marcus Rashford on right back, Jadon Sancho on, both to take penalties. And well, we know how it worked out, but was that your plan C, was it? You know, it was just like, this could not have been the worst.
No, penalties were the plan B. But let's be honest about it. I think there was, you could see from throughout extra time, that there was an acceptance. And you know, that's the one thing you would say is a kind of, whereas England really grew into the game against Denmark and took it to Denmark and they looked like they were going for the winner, there was no very, very little sign of that in this game. There was, the, as Tom said, there was the odd little flash kind of, but no, I think, but as again, I really can't bring myself to criticise Gareth Southgate too much because the margins still were very fine. We could have been here today celebrating the greatest moment in England's modern history, but you missed a couple of penalty kicks.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing as well from the team Gareth bandwagon that I've been on for a long time and I will remain on until he decides to leave as England head coach is that you're right, Hugh, the in-game reactions, and Alisson's right, the plan B and plan C, but you have to remember as well that we've praised him so much for having lots of different plan A's. It's like, it's kind of like he's got all these different files and plans that have kickoff and, you know, they're all plan A and they're all different, but he's not able to meld them and merge them into one game plan where you can switch between the two. That's what I found so strange. When the changes happened, I thought, okay, we're switching to four at the back now. We'll see the kind of performances that we've put in when we've played a back four. But it seems to unravel during the game. That's if we're trying to be hypercritical here, and I don't want listeners to think that our classic journalists slagging off an England team that have nearly brought us glory. But if we've got to be analytical, that's what they need to then improve on. It's that in-game ability to switch between systems because they've been brilliant at it. We've praised them for it. One of the most unique teams in tournament. My memories of football. Having so many different systems, so many different ways of playing from kickoff, but then not being able to change it during a game. And I mean, if that's obvious, that's maybe more difficult, is it, Gregor, than doing before a game when you can in training for a few days, this is how we're going to play. But I would have thought you'd be able to adapt during a game when you've been so adaptable throughout the tournament.
Yeah. I mean, when you're countering what the other team are trying to do, you know, that's a different dynamic, undoubtedly. But I think you got to say England were superb in the first half. Like, yeah. It's the best I've ever seen them play this system. They were fluid. There was always either five men joining an attack or five men behind the ball. They looked solid at both ways and got poor bodies forward. As you say, Rice was pouring forward. Kane was dropping in. Deep show, like, causing all sorts of trouble. Raheem Sterling's playing more on the shoulder of the last man. Mount was drifting in a lot of pockets of space. The two wing backs linked up to get the goal. Kyle Walker was bombing forward. So there was no, although they played that system, you watched it thinking, this is smart and this is the best way they've ever played this. I just think you've got to also give Italy credit for the fact that they're a very good team and they found solutions. They grew into the game. They exerted their control and their dominance in the ball of the ball, and that ultimately wore England down. But still, it was a couple of penalty kicks.
It's almost like management, where you plan. And Johnny Northcroft said this on Twitter: England and Southgate are very good at stopping other teams doing what they want to do from the start. But you then have to. It's almost like Gareth Southgate then needs to go and think, right, well, how will they counter our system, and how can I then reflect on that? Because if we thought about it, you know, it's very different games and different circumstances. But we were discussing it with Denmark and Wales, weren't we? And how they changed system. And I think, Hugh, you said it, how it almost looked like Denmark had deliberately planned that way. Almost like, oh, right, we'll show them this side of us for 10 minutes and then we'll flip on them and they won't be able to handle it. And Wales couldn't. They couldn't handle it once Denmark changed to a back four during the game. And so that's an incredibly difficult thing for a manager to kind of envisage, right, well, how might Italy counter our first punch and how can you then react to that? So, that's maybe what Southgate's got to work on.
For me, I'm never against in knockout football spoiling the game. I'm never against that. I'm never against, they've put four players in the middle of the pitch, go and put four players in the middle of the pitch. Tell your players to go through them, tackle, run, compete for everything. Just don't let them get on top of you. I'm not against that either. So you don't necessarily have to have an amazing plan up your sleeve, but you have to look on the pitch. I was screaming at the guy next to me. Why hasn't he changed the system? Declan Rice and Calvin. There were times I felt so sorry for Calvin Phillips. The ball's getting passed straight, by the way, from Jorginho into the forward's feet. Like that is never a good sign. Your entire central midfield area is just being bypassed. You just haven't got enough bodies in there. No one's screening the defense. Like you just needed to do something, and he just sat there, and it took a goal to make him do something. And that for me is never good management. I don't want to be harsh on him. It finished 1-1 after extra time, but
I think we're right to make the points we make, but you know, with the heavy caveat that he deserves a lot of praise through the tournament. But I mean, has anyone got any good suggestions for what he should have done? Because, you know, try and be constructive.
Well, they've played 4-2-3-1. They played 4-2-3-1. They've played it well. But for me, when that happened, I wanted Mason Mount to sit on Jorginho when he was still on, because Jorginho was the one that was really dictating it. He was telling all of his teammates where to go. No one got close to him, really. And I wanted Rice and Phillips to go back to how they played in the last two games as two sitters and try and stop the balls going through to the forwards. And I think he still could have made changes from there, still would have had his two wide players, still could have gone to a 4-3-3 in attack. And then the thing is, when he changed it, we came back into the game a little bit more. But when he changed it, he had a different type of defence. He had one holding midfielder, and he pushed Jordan Henderson a little bit further forward than Declan Rice had played, and he started pressing. And like I say, he got a draw and he got it to penalties, so I'm not going to be harsh on him. But I'm saying it almost allowed Italy to become really comfortable in the game, and I think that helped them massively. That's all I'm saying. Alisson, have I been unfair at all? Gregor, go on.
I think we can get a little bit bogged. We have done. We certainly have. I think you could get bogged down in the system. I think in the first half, when they were playing it well, Kane and Mount were getting around Jorginho. Yes, he wasn't playing. Mount wasn't playing directly in the hole, you know, in the vicinity, but he was still. Jorginho didn't have much effect in the game in the first half. So when they played it well, I just think Italy deserves some credit. But also, it was more of an attitude. They retreated, and Italy's attitude always throughout the tournament, apart from against Spain, when Spain, they recognised that Spain were more dominant and they were better on the ball technically than them. That's when you saw the real resolve. And you know, so there's two things. England don't have that first kind of, what's the word? The disbelief. They don't have the belief that they can dominate the game for 90 minutes. And they don't quite have, although they concede two goals in the tournament, they don't quite have the same kind of gnarly nous that the Italians have when they need to sit in and soak up all the pressure in the world and see out a game. So personally, I think it's kind of, it's mindset as much as anything. England have come on leaps and leaps and leaps and bounds in terms of, you keep talking about technical players. England have got some of the best technical players in the world. They still have a little weak point in midfield. Declan Rice and Phillips were outstanding. I'm not taking anything away from them, their performances throughout the tournament. But when you look at the very best teams, they're lacking something. But I think it's more than anything, it's an attitude and a mindset sort of thing that England probably have to work on.
I agree with that, Gregor. I felt that England had the upper hand initially because I think they felt good that Spinazzola was out, and they exploited that fact. And they had that sort of arrogance that goes with, you know, a wolf looking at a wounded animal, and they got that early goal, and I think it rocked Italy, and I think probably Italy felt that they were a good man down in that sense. But then psychologically, Italy making the better changes and starting to have an impact on the flanks and sort of flooding and being more interesting and offering different dynamics. You're absolutely right. England then felt they'd lost their ace card, retreated, and that makes you tired. And if you're going to do that sort of football, you have to be quicker from a managerial point of view on how you're going to handle that. You either counter it by surprising Italy by doing something interesting from the bench. I think if we're talking about mindsets, what must it have done to the Italian coaching team and the players on the bench to have seen substitutes for England loitering, nothing decisive was happening. You know, at one point I thought, oh my goodness, these subs aren't even going to get on for penalties. There's just so much hanging around. I kept thinking, oh, has the camera missed someone coming on? Because I've seen someone ready to come on for so long. that is not good. That doesn't look good from, you know, it's excellent from the opposition point of view. Makes you look like you're dillying and dallying, and you don't want to do that in a final.
Alison, I want to talk about a few players before we move on. One on the England side, a couple Italians as well. Harry Kane for England. No attempt in terms of a shot. He didn't create a chance either for only the second time in his 61 England games. The other was a 29-minute substitute appearance against Switzerland in 2018. Thank you, Opta, for that stat. What do you make of his tournament as a whole? Was he at the level, do you think, for a player of his quality?
He had moments where he was. He had moments where he looked like when he was at his best for Spurs, when he was prepared to be intellectual about it and drop deep when he could and provide that extra bit of class to get a ball forward that was meaningful. I think his physicality is excellent. He wins lots of free kicks, and he was doing that at the start of the game. He must be a nightmare to play against. But it is a bit worrying that our talisman and captain completely disappeared from the game. And I wonder if he just wasn't really, throughout the tournament, he wasn't at 100% physically, just, you know, in terms of pure match fitness. I'm not saying he was injured. I just don't think he was at pure match fitness. He has had this thing where he has always in his career pushed himself, never wanted a manager to rest him, or he's always rushed back from injury. That has to take its toll. And I think, you know, towards the latter stages of the game, he looked tired. And that's, again, it's about how you manage your key players. Harry Kane will have told Southgate, "Don't you dare rest me." And sometimes you have to say, well, maybe, you know, we have to manage his minutes better. I don't think overall his minutes were managed well.
As I say, I thought in the first half he was brilliant. I thought he was causing Italy all sorts of problems. And I think every time that we've had this conversation, there's probably been a broader issue in the game that has affected Harry Kane quite profoundly. A lot of the time he wasn't getting the ball in the opening group games, and there was nobody really close to him. And he was magnificent against Denmark. And as I say, I thought he was brilliant in the first half, caused Italy so much trouble. Because as I say, the thing that impressed me most was the kind of the fluidity of it. You know, the players moving beyond, he was deeper than Mason Mount for majority of the game in the first half. And Italy didn't really know how to deal with it, and his link-up play was brilliant. And then, you know, Italy grew into the game and his influence waned, and I don't think you can just lay that at the feet of Harry Kane.
I really don't think any England player had a below-par tournament, really. I think that's the other reason, when you reflect on this tournament from an England point of view and the fine margins and getting to a final, a lot of these players performed way above the level that a lot of us would have expected. A lot of the players in this team, I think we've come into this tournament thinking Calvin Phillips was a good midfielder. He now looks like, you know, a top
the
level
Yorkshire
midfielder.
Pirlo.
Seriously, no, but I mean, the Yorkshire Pirlo is obviously kind of a Leeds fan thing, and they all have been proudly advocating his brilliance. But the guy looks absolutely unbelievable. Same for Declan Rice. Lots of this England team outperformed the levels that we would have expected from them. And I think Harry Kane had a good tournament. I think, as Greg has said, any fault or that may lie with Harry Kane in this tournament is about the greater whole of England as a team and what the opposition have done to them, perhaps tactically on the pitch. I think it's too restrictive to just say Harry Kane is a striker. He didn't have shots. He didn't score goals. He is therefore not good. I think Harry Kane gets an 8 out of 10. I think lots of the other players get 9s and even 10s out of 10s. I think the whole squad were overall pretty brilliant, really.
Speaking of 10 out of 10s, I wanted to talk about the two Italian centre-backs, Giorgio Chiellini, Leonardo Bonucci, 36 and 34 years old, respectively. I got to witness one of the great centre-back pairings last night, so that was another honour for me personally. Gregor, as a defender, watching that game last night, Bonucci even scored a goal, man of the match performance. But they were just, again, they were just wily. They just knew what they were doing. It was the experience, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, and the dark arts were needed. I mean, poor Saka, he had a tough night even getting hauled to the floor before the penalty kicks. We mentioned them. And even that moment, he was on a yellow card then, and Sterling skipped round him. He did that thing that the best defenders do, where they know how to do enough without quite making it a foul, You know, he kind of leaned on Sterling, probably a little bit of a tug of the shirt, wrapped his leg around him. And this, you know, that was probably England's best chance in extra time. And he just did enough without conceding a penalty, without getting, you know, sent off. That is the mark of a truly brilliant defender. And look, I personally think that, you know, as much as I love them, like with all my heart, slightly too much has been made of their kind of supremacy in this tournament. I think much as they've been excellent, there's been moments where Chiellini has looked 36. You know, the goal against Belgium being one. And, you know, although he knows what to do in those moments, he, you know, in the moments where he looks like he's going to be exposed, I think probably we're seeing the end of this partnership. And what a partnership.
Come on, Gregor. They were charismatic. They were incredible.
Absolutely. The presence is another big thing. The fact that they are on the pitch just inspires the team.
One of the moments of the tournament is the Jordi Alba hug before the penalty shootout, isn't it? Chiellini kind of just giving him a big hug and a grin before a semi-final penalty shootout in a European Championships.
I bet Kane was kind of approaching him warily at the end there.
Yeah, thinking, don't hug me. Please don't hug me. Don't make me look like it. Tit. But there's a great moment before the match as well, just in kind of Tom's tips for things to look up on YouTube or Twitter, where Chiellini and Maguire met in the tunnel and Chiellini comes up to him with a massive grin on his face. This is a guy you're about to face in the final, and he goes, big man, and gives him a massive hug, like just in a kind of, yes, this is great. And then he walks off and he does this kind of like fist bump dance type thing, as if to say, you're well up for this, come on, let's have it. It is, as Alison, like their charisma is superb as well. That's been a massive part of it.
I love Chiellini's post-match interview in his lovely English, like the most enthusiastic waiter you'll ever meet in your life in your best Italian restaurant. Everything on the menu is amazing. And his English was beautiful and his accent was beautiful. But what they did Gregor's stressed their age, but my very favourite defenders are ones that are a bit older, but what they lack in pace, they make up for in their brain. So you'd see a move, and then suddenly out the corner of your eye, you'd see one of them just appearing at exactly the right moment because they'd read the danger and they'd run in the most time effective way to intercept. It was just absolutely beautiful reading of the game, which you have to have if you're over 34. You have to have it. And I just thought their timing, their reading of the game, their chests out, I honestly felt, I said at one point, I think Chiellini would take out a saw and chop off his leg if he felt it would mean the team would win. And you can't put a price on that sort of passion, can you? I don't think you can.
Chiellini had one of those moments you're describing against Sterling, I think, in the second half, where they were exposed and he kind of turned and just made a beeline for Sterling. I think he's tried to cross, he was sliding in, and you know, he gets up and punches there. And also, in the goal, the guy who was kind of made sure the ball got through in the first place was Chiellini, kind of, I can't remember, I think it was maybe Stones, he was just doing enough to kind of bear hug so the ball got past them, and then Bonucci's the man to tap it in. They're a real threat in the opposition box as well. So, yeah, look, their presence has been enormous for Italy.
The penalties: Kane, Maguire, Rashford, Sancho, Saka. Saka, the fourth youngest player to appear in a Euros final, taking the fifth penalty for England. I'm not going to say that smacked of not having a plan either, but it was an interesting decision, generally speaking, to see those five take penalties. No, I'm just saying, look, Rashford and Sancho came off the bench for 90 seconds to take pens. That's a plan in itself. I'm just asking the question whether you feel
it's the right plan
one.
Or not. That's the only question. But Italy, the thing we have to say, I wrote a piece in the Sunday Times that touched on this, is England have studied penalties like in meticulous detail now for 5 years. A guy called Rhys Long, who's the head of analysis and insight, drove this report. And, you know, England have won the last two penalty shootouts. It's covered everything, you know, so you see them taking the between 3 and 5 seconds, they pause between the referee's whistle and beginning the run-up. It's to take ownership of the kick. The study found that the best penalty taker should go first. So people saying you should put one of your best kickers fourth and fifth because of the pressure things. They have, their studies found that the best takers, you go in order from best to worst. And even little details about the psychology of it, where if you miss, you should try and conceal your emotions as much as you can. I know that's not going to be easy. So the negativity doesn't spread through the camp. And you saw Chiellini, whenever Italy missed, and you saw him in the semi-final too, he kind of instantly corrected himself and he was up saying, applauding, saying, come on, we're still in this. So like, they touch on everything. So people blaming, trying to look for escape. It was astonishing. Like within minutes of the penalty shootout last night, you look on social media and people are looking for scapegoats saying, why didn't Raheem Sterling, experienced, or John Stones or whoever, why didn't they take one? Why have they left it to a 19-year-old kid? It's because he's the fifth best penalty taker on the pitch and they practiced it every single day, down to knowing who stands next to whom on the sidelines. Even the coach, so they know where the kit man stands, whether he stands next to the physio. They've practiced it the same way every single day in training. And so you might be right in that he was a 19-year-old kid and the pressure was too much, but A, he was the fifth best penalty taker, and B, he wanted to take it. So I think, again, England do this very well. You're looking for scapegoats where there shouldn't be any.
Yeah, Greg is right. That was the thing that was telling about Southgate's comments, was that as well as being very Gareth Southgate-esque and taking it all on his shoulders, he said very honestly that this was based on training, and that particularly Sancho and Rashford were two of the best takers of penalties in training based on the work that they'd done. So I don't think there can be any doubt or over-analysis about who should have taken one. I'd note it's also interesting this morning, Jack Grealish has tweeted, I said I wanted to take one, !! Don't ever say that I didn't want a penalty. The gaffer has made so many right decisions during this tournament, and he did tonight. You know, that's definitely making it very clear this was a plan. This was who was taking them. This was completely thought through. And also probably that any of the other players who didn't manage to take a penalty would have taken a penalty, but it was based on the training. And also, just very quickly, let's briefly say that if Manchester United aren't giving Harry Maguire penalties from next season, there's something very wrong with it. Jesus Christ, what a tournament he's had, by the way. And for
he broke
that,
the camera.
step up, bang it into the top corner, second penalty, don't worry about it. And he gave a brilliant, he looked a bit like, you know, the WWE wrestlers where they do like a finisher move and then stare off into the distance or into the crowd as if to say, you doubted me, you tossers. And it was fantastic. it was one of those moments that would be forgotten because of what happened. But fair play, Harry Maguire. What a penalty take.
At the end of the penalties, I was left thinking, because I knew all that Gregor had said. I knew that England had done so much work on the fine detail, the how you breathe, how you react, and so on. I thought, okay, you can shove your 5 years of research, just get your biggest players to hoof it. That's how you take a penalty shooter.
I mean, my initial reaction was, I thought they practiced every day. So, you know, you can look at it in many, many different ways. I was obviously hurt and disappointed by it. And, you know, fans will have all those questions on how it could have gone differently because we got so many good players.
I just briefly want to mention my best mate, Jordan Pickford, again. I mean, I know I've already mentioned it, but the guy saved two penalties in a penalty shootout for an England goalkeeper. And it was interesting. There's a clip going around on Twitter this morning in relation to what Gregor said about mindset just before the Jorginho penalty. And I know lots is made about Pickford being, you know, mad as a bag of spiders at times in his performances on the pitch. But I love him and I think we should cherish him because he's had a fantastic tournament. And before he's about to face Jorginho, the most chilled out, showy, composed penalty taker, he's saying to himself, no problem, come on, no problem, come on, no problem. And he waits and saves that penalty. I know it means nothing. It means nothing. And it'll mean nothing to Jordan Pickford. But that is a serious, serious penalty save. And my love for Jordan Pickford knows no bounds. The guy's a hero for me.
That's the fine lines we're talking about. He would have been a national hero. Like if England had gone on to win the tournament with penalty kicks. Like the margins were so, so thin. And, you know, it's understandable. It's natural to try and pick out all these things now, but there was nothing in it.
I mean, the perception of Jordan Pickford, I think, definitely changed during this tournament. And that's great news for him and for England as well. And funnily enough, I was saying in the stands that I was confident on penalties because of Jordan Pickford, despite what I've said about him in the past.
Yes, you. Yes.
he is a goalkeeper that likes to partake in a little bit of S-housery, and it seems always seems to work for him. So I do enjoy that. And I said, he'll wait as long as possible to put them off. And he came walking out of his six-yard box every single time the players put the ball on the spot and had to be forced back onto the goal line by the referee. And he made them take as long as possible. But also, I actually think he's very athletic. And in a penalty shootout, a goalkeeper like that, it really works. And the only other goalkeeper that's better is a giant, and that was Donnarumma on the evening. So again, I just can't be harsh about England. I can, though, maybe be harsh on the fans who barged their way into Wembley Stadium, causing a stampede at times. There were some awful scenes in London generally yesterday. I went into Leicester Square, and that was just absolute chaos. So I decided to go straight up to Wembley Way, which wasn't much better at the time. And then I went inside the stadium and I was just shocked, generally speaking, about what I experienced. I've been to Wembley so many times as a fan to watch England, never seen anything like it. I had to wait an hour to get in because they'd stopped letting people in because they'd already let in too many people that didn't have tickets. And this is the experience of journalists that I've spoken to, friends in other parts of the stadium. Every single one of them was surrounded by dozens of people. There must have been hundreds, if not thousands, in the stadium last night who managed to get in without a ticket. And it's one thing barging your way into the stadium. It's totally another thing that people were going up to the turnstiles and basically using screenshots on their phones and the same ticket hundreds of times probably, and going into the stadium through normal channels. I mean, firstly, I didn't get searched at all, you know, when I went into the stadium, which for security reasons already, you're a bit like, okay. And then, of course, it was meant to be a COVID test event, COVID secure test event. And I went and got a lateral flow test in the morning, first thing, to make sure I had the results back in time so I could go into the stadium. And I got the NHS app downloaded and all that stuff. And to be surrounded by people who didn't even have a ticket and clearly hadn't gone through that process, you know, at a time when we're getting so many new cases, was again a massive worry. You know, this is a country that wants to co-host a World Cup. For an event of this size to be, you know, infiltrated, if you like, in that way, I thought it was absolutely ridiculous. And that's aside from the scenes of violence and some of the casual racism experienced on the day as well. It didn't detract from the experience from me because I wanted to make sure that I remember that day for all the right reasons. But it is a big, big negative and something the FA really have to investigate. Alison, what did you make of it all?
Well, you're very gracious, Hugh. I mean, I don't know how you can be so positive after that. I'm embarrassed yet again to be English. And it's something we do not deserve to be able to host a tournament. It's absolute shambles. I absolutely hate the booing of the other national anthems. I mean, what is that about? It's a sport where you shake hands, you say, may the best team win, and then you get into it. Beforehand, you're supposed to have respect for what's going on and to not understand that the team you're facing have earned the right to be there. And you're hosting it. You're supposed to be, when you host, you're supposed to be gracious and beautiful. And there was no beauty in the attitude at all. And I've heard about Italian fans, you know, near pubs or trying to enjoy the game and being beaten up because their team had scored. Absolutely disgraceful. And people say, oh, it's not really football fans. Well, it is. I'm afraid it is football fans and it's connected to football. And it doesn't do anyone any good or help at all to say, oh, it's just jobs. It's nothing to do with jobs. It's to do with our relationship with how we use football as part of our national identity. And it's an absolute disgrace. And if you may have picked up, I sort of get hypercritical about England and not very starry-eyed about them. It's because in 92, I went as an official England fan. I was, you know, I had the pack. I'd got my tickets to follow England around Euro 92. And it was just one long, constant need to pretend I wasn't English. I had to throw away my garb that identified me as English because people were horrible to me because I was English. And when they didn't know I was English, then I could get into conversations with them and I could speak to really drunk fans from anywhere else who, while drunk, were still polite and happy and joyous. The English fans in Sweden were put into, it was like they were put in a cage in a zoo so that other fans could go and watch them be disgusting. And I was just embarrassed. The worst hooliganism I've ever seen between two sets of fans in Europe that were not English was the Dutch and the Germans. And you know what they did? they threw marigolds at each other. That's how nasty it got. And then they apologized. We are revolting, and we do not deserve to host anything ever again. I am appalled by what you said, Hugh. I mean, I wasn't even there, and I'm shaking on your behalf. It's absolutely disgraceful, and I am yet again embarrassed to be associated with the national team. So there, take that.
I mean, there were some Benny Hill type scenarios at the end of security guards. I mean, aside from the person that got onto the pitch, I mean, that was a similar case as I was exiting the stadium, and for various security infringements, they were chasing fans around. I mean, it was absolutely comical. I felt the whole stadium was under-policed. I've been to major tournaments. Of course, I was at the Euros elsewhere this summer as well. And Wembley Way itself, there was nowhere near enough policing. But the stadium itself, you know, people were just walking up to the turnstiles, you know, at Wembley Stadium for an event of that size. You know, I don't want to be too serious about this, but I'm from London. We've seen, you know, attacks in London before. You know, to think that you're in a huge group of thousands of other people and you're not being protected at an event that would obviously be targeted, if it were to be targeted, you know, it would be on the list, wouldn't it? I just thought it was absolutely ridiculous. And like I say, I really expect it to be looked into, because...
Why aren't you more angry, Hugh? I'm angry that you're not angry.
like I say, I was tweeting about it last night, and all the tweets that would usually come out about the game, I don't think I've tweeted about the game. But the thing is, I didn't want to remember the day for that. And I'm determined to not remember the day for that. Because, like I say, it was meant to be a special day. I just thought, you know, it was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. I mean, I had kids sitting around me, you know, bragging to one another about how they'd got into the stadium and having a right old giggle about it. And you're just standing there listening to these stories thinking, this is incredible. I'm standing next to a kid, but I could conceivably be standing next to any kind of bad person right now, you know, 2 yards away from me, and I've not been protected at all. And these people are saying they came through the turnstile. They're not saying that they forced their way into the ground. They literally put a screenshot underneath the ticket scanner and it opened for them, you know, and the same thing opened for thousands, the same screenshot opened for hundreds of others probably. That system is clearly not fit for purpose, you know. And what happened is we got held up. Fans were singing, you know, let us in, let us in, let us in. You're not fit for the job. And they were banging on the walls, like, because they kept us outside for so long, people with legitimate tickets. And the reason they couldn't let any more people in at that time, which was about an hour before kickoff, was because they'd clearly noticed that there were so many people in the stadium already, with tens of thousands of more making their way in at that point in time. And I heard from a journalist inside that the Bluetooth, they hadn't basically used the Bluetooth setting with the turnstiles that links the ticket, the physical image with the ticket that you have. So people were getting in and it was saying it's a ticket and opening the turnstile. But in fact, because the Bluetooth wasn't on, if it wasn't a ticket, that Bluetooth connection would have said, this is not a ticket. And so people had just got into the stadium. That's horrendous, personally.
There's two aspects to this. There's one is the operational procedures of Wembley, which clearly have been a shambles, and the other is the people still like to say it's a minority, but I think you're kidding yourself, because they're there in voice and might, generation after generation after generation. The people who sing the songs that we all know, who trash, usually it's cities in other country, but they trashed the city centre of their own capital. They stormed the national stadium, and then, you know, as some of the video footage showing, started beating up the people who were storming in. So it's almost like we're going to defend their own stadium. There's another subsection of fans, you know, who wanted to beat up the guys who were coming in. And then, you know, he started by, again, you say it's a minority, but you heard them, started the tournament by booing the players taking the knee, and ended it by the three black kids who missed penalties being racially abused. It was a wretched day for England. Like, put all the football aside, it was a wretched day for England. And like, particularly sad after how much hope and sort of positivity this team has inspired. And some of the words, you know, reading the papers over Saturday and Sunday, some beautiful pieces about what this team, it's kind of young, diverse, pretty fearless team, and a emotionally intelligent manager at the helm has done, or has kind of, you know, people were saying this represents the best of England. And as I say, just a positivity, kind of unifying, or it should have been unifying. And within hours, the contrast between that and, you know, the kind of veneer slipping a little bit, saying that, sorry, no, this is England as well. That is England as well. And it's something that is, you know, it might be hard to swallow. It might be distasteful, but that is every much a part of England as the kind of positive message that we've been seeing from this young team throughout the tournament. And, you know, I find that sad. I'm not English, but I've lived here for 17 or 18 years, and I love a lot about England, and I love the vast majority of these people. I was sad this morning waking up looking at the kind of how a day of euphoria and national unity could be turned into one of ignominy.
This team certainly didn't deserve this. Gregor's right. There's probably, not for this podcast and for someone more intellectual than me, there's a conversation to be had surely about the English football fan and its relationship with alcohol too, and how they, you know, make that part of the match day experience. Because
not just alcohol, Tom, unfortunately.
Well, I won't, as I say, this is for another podcast then. But I mean, you know, I am a season ticket holder of a club, and I don't witness people storming grounds, but I witness behaviour on a regular basis that I just think that's abhorrent. And it is often based on the fact that people have got up early and are absolutely written off by kickoff. And that's for a 3 o'clock game. And this game was 8 p.m. I was walking to the Times offices in London Bridge through central London, and there were people, and I was looking at them thinking, they're not even going to make kickoff. They're going to be completely written off by kickoff, by 6 o'clock even. And that's not to excuse it, but it's to say that it's a massive part of the problem in the drinking culture in this country, and the way that it goes hand in hand with the way a lot of football fans think that's part of the match day experience. I go to a Lincoln game and I maybe have half a pint with my dad at the pub beforehand, because any more than that and it would distract me from watching the game. But we've all been there. We've all been in the stands with fans who aren't even watching the game. But part of their day is that the game is the thing which the day revolves around. But the day is actually just getting hammered with their mates. And sometimes there's nothing wrong with that. I've had great times with my mates getting drunk and watching the football. But that is a massive part of it. And yesterday, it brought out the worst in a lot of people. And as Alison said, it was pretty abhorrent.
I mean, for me, yeah. The thing is, one of the reasons that I don't get angry, and even the racist abuse, you know, Alison, it's so expected now. I mean, it's, how can you get annoyed about it? You know, it is what happens. It's just what happens now. We've seen it all season. And I, like I say, I've been to a load of England games. You know, I do expect to hear those songs. Casual racism that people thinks is funny. You know, the saddest thing for me is after about an hour of the game yesterday, because I'd seen people around me with their kids, and I don't know, I heard the kids screaming. It entered my consciousness. I thought, if I had kids, I would not want them to be here, which is a sad thing for a major final in the place that I was raised, you know, watching England. But I was looking around, and I was almost in awe of the people that were in there with their kids, you know, the England fans are in there with their kids and trying to behave. I mean, there were England fans, by the way, with kids around me who weren't trying to behave and fell into the other category. But, you know, the people that had gone with their kids to just enjoy it, I was almost in awe of them, you know, putting up with it, to be honest.
Yeah, but in summary, Hugh, you really wanted to go and you were excited to get a ticket. And your experience was you were supposed to be at a COVID test event. You did not feel safe in any sense that you might be protected from COVID. You did not feel safe from a terrorist attack because people were going through with rucksacks that were not being checked. You were not safe in terms of the color of your skin because you experienced and heard racist abuse. People were behaving rudely, using language that you found abhorrent, and children were being encouraged to behave abhorrently. And England lost. I do not see why you want to treasure that event one iota.
I think there's two other things worth considering. One is, I think, well, the impression I'm getting is it was quite an edgy atmosphere, and whether that had any sort of influence on the team. And another is, if this team has been seen as quite, as I say, they've kind of unburdened, unshackled from the past disappointments, and you know, despite the boos for a gesture that was, they clearly said was an anti-racism gesture, you know, they stood tall and kind of, and won that argument, I would suggest. You know, there was a loud applause for the game. That changed even through the tournament. But after seeing their teammates racially abused on social media and seeing the state of their fans, how is their relationship with England now again? Has it gone backwards a little bit? This is supposed to be a positive summer for England. I personally think that a part of the problem for England's players has been who they're representing. I don't blame them for that.
I think there's a group of football fans that don't necessarily care that much about the team, as in the players on the pitch. They have a team, and at national level, that is England, and that is what they represent. But it is just the vehicle for which they're... I've been to Lincoln games before. I remember one, I won't name the team, but I got on the train back to London with a load of away fans having been to a Lincoln game. And Lincoln had won in the last minute of the game. And their team... their fans then kicked off with a load of our stewards. And I was stood with my girlfriend at the time in quite a tense part of this train carriage, with surrounded by away fans who were all saying what a great day they'd had because they'd let off a flare and punched a steward. And I was sitting there thinking, your team have just lost to a rival in the last minute of an important game. And they were like, a class day. Oh, look, I've ripped my jacket. Oh, did you see Jimmy land that bloke? Oh, he punched him in the face. Yeah. Like, the football is just the vehicle for their day, and that what they want to happen to go around. So I don't, the fans, I don't think they care about this brilliant team. And that's what's so sad. This articulate manager, these well-spoken young players with great thoughts on social justice and, you know, children's education and things like that. They don't care. They don't really care. It's not about that. It's about England, Three Lions, St. George's. Not bothered about who's on the pitch.
I've said it so many times before, though. I have always felt like football in general as a sport has allowed a climate of aggression for a long time inside the stadium. And it goes from the managers screaming at officials on the touchline, players in the face of the referee. And of course, that spreads into the crowd. I mean, there is no limit.
That's a European and worldwide truth of football. But every other nation, when they join together and they meet and they come together for a tournament, they tend to do it pretty merrily and calmly and happily, and you know, in a spirit of friendship. That's the difference. So there's something, it's something deeper than just, you know, talking about the lads getting pissed up and them not caring about the football team. It's about national identity. I think we should knock it in the head there, because football, you know, it was a bad day for England in that respect, but England got to a final. I think you got to hold on to that, because, I mean, certainly if Scotland had done that, you'd be scraping me off the walls.
Okay, well, let's look
ceiling,
ahead to...
Ceiling, that's the phrase, isn't it? Ceiling, sorry.
Yeah, well, whichever. You know, you might spill down onto the walls, I don't know. Anyway, let's look ahead to what England might do under Gareth Southgate, because I think he's going to get a new contract. He definitely deserves it. We've reached a final, and we got a winning culture back in English football during the last 5 or 6 weeks, whatever it was, because I think we realised it was about getting through round after round. It wasn't about playing like Spain or Germany and all those things that I've said before, or playing like Brazil. You know, we found a way, we got some confidence back, and we reached a final, which is huge because the level of expectation goes up. I mean, it might not be a good thing in the end, the level of expectation going up, but it's something for us to aim for. England have set themselves a high bar. So I want to ask you finally on England, what you hope for with this group of players under Gareth Southgate in the coming years?
More of the same, I think, is a boring answer, because let's be honest, both of the last two major tournaments have ended with what-ifs and forensic analysis, but they've also given England, you know, I've said it before, the amount of eulogising that goes on around Euro 96, this team have now given the fans two tournaments back-to-back that have been as good, if not better, in terms of performance and moments. That win against Germany at Wembley, what a great game that was. A fantastic game of football, incredibly tense, and I actually... we're going to come on to our favourite moments in a minute, but I was looking back and those two goals that England scored against Germany were superb, really good team goals, incredible moments. So more of the same. Don't doubt yourselves to any of the players or to Gareth Southgate. And yes, there are things to maybe improve on. Yes, things to work on, as we've picked over already. But more of the same, more special moments. I'm already looking forward to the World Cup.
Okay, we've mentioned on the podcast Calvin Phillips being called the Yorkshire Pirlo. Well, he's not, is he? And that's the point. He's wonderful, Calvin Phillips. I love his energy and his, you know, just relentless getting involved. We need as a nation to start finding. There's a big hole in. Okay, where are our cultured midfielders? We've got good fullbacks. Too many good fullbacks. We've got great centre halves. We've got loads of players who can play behind a number nine or part of a three behind a striker. There's no one really who can dictate technically and in terms of cerebrally looking at the game and take over and be calm and pick out the passes relentlessly. I mean, through the 90 minutes. I mean, just, or even as a midfield unit do that. So we've had lots of talk about how England have progressed from the youth, lower age groups. The FA are keen that we develop properly, that Gareth Southgate knows what's happening at under 18 level, as well as what's happening when he goes to watch Kieran Trippier play in Spain. You know, he's got his eye on it all, but we're not breeding intelligent, technically gifted footballers in the middle of the park yet. And I don't think, and if we'd won, yeah, we could have won. We could have beaten Italy on penalties, perhaps. But I still think if we were honest and we'd done that, we'd have said we got lucky and we weren't the most gifted team over the entire match. And I want England to be able to, now we've got 4G pictures everywhere. Why haven't we got players that can play football, please? Thank you very much.
You need Billy Gilmore. That's your problem. I actually agree with Alison, but I would caveat that with, you know, that's the one thing that England lack. But I've watching this tournament, I've kind of come to believe that if you did have that kind of player and that player emerged, then Gareth Southgate and Steve Holland, they're pragmatists at heart, and I think they would know how to change the way England played accordingly. So, and again, you've got to look at the winners of the last two major tournaments, France and Portugal, and they did it pretty kind of in pretty similar fashion to England. They were solid and they had a bit of stardust up front. And yes, England have got a bit more of that on the pitch at times, perhaps. But I think really, I kind of agree with Tom too, in that you've got to, don't try and rip it up and start again or anything like that. It's got to be, you've got a smart guy in the dugout, an excellent backroom staff around him too, which he's helped assemble. And there's been a lot of thought into making England a better national team. And there's been a huge improvement. And I actually think probably the rate at which you're developing players now, it won't be long until you see a Billy Gilmore in the England strip.
quickly wanted to mention that Gareth Southgate has been speaking while we've been talking. Says, as a manager, you have to accept there will be intense analysis, so hopefully he enjoys his podcast. We've benefited a lot from praise during the tournament. There will be a lot said after the game. I have to accept the analysis when things don't go right. You make hundreds of decisions day in, day out during the tournament. Some you get right and some that you don't. You have to get more right than wrong, so I take responsibility and take the criticism that comes with that. I have to take that. If I didn't get all the decisions right last night, so be it. I have to live with that. And I just, it's quite sad for me to see that because, you know, after Euro 96, etc., I wanted this to be, you know, he should leave with a positive feeling instead of people like me criticising him. So Gareth Southgate, keep doing your thing, even if it means two holding midfielders. Sad as it ended, of course. Well, it did. Look, he can do what he wants now. I'm firmly Team Gareth, and Gregor, though you laugh, I know you are too. Up next, we'll look back at the tournament as a whole, some of the best and worst, of course. But if you've enjoyed the podcast so far, leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcast from, and make sure you're subscribed at thetimes.co.uk/the game.
Hold up. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
So we've just about got time to reflect on Euro 2020 as a tournament, which I think we can all agree was a fantastic one from start to finish, really great for the England fans. But I guess the only negative I would have about it is the travel, which hopefully they will sort out soon, because some teams just had to travel way too far. But apart from that, I think it went really, really well. Even though what I said about Wembley in the final, I still think it was a great tournament. The Michael Jackson inspired choreographers was maybe a little bit too much. But apart from that, it was brilliant. So let's talk about who we thought was, we'll give out some of our awards. And let's start with player of the tournament. Alison, who was yours?
I honestly thought everyone would go for him. Simon Kjær. Simon Kjær. The Denmark captain. I mean, unbelievable tournament, because the way he responded when his teammate Christian Eriksen collapsed, absolutely impeccable. And also putting his Christian's partner first, the teammates first, not worrying, doing all the right things. I think he even actually probably physically helped save his life. And then it turns out he's a blooming amazing defender as well, and a leader on the pitch. Really one of the players of the tournament, both on and off the pitch, and you know, without doubt the player of the tournament, because I think it's very easy now to forget just how upset we all were in those scenes in that Denmark game. And it was thanks to him that it, you know, they had a sort of happy ending in the way, and that Christian's fine. So I just don't see how you can not look at him. Don't look beyond him. He is the player of the tournament, man of the year.
Jordan Pickford. No, I'm joking. Sorry. he comes in. He's easily in my top five. Is Jordan? It's a tough one. I'm going to have to go with Jorginho. I think got to pick a player from the team that won it. I think he was superb for Chelsea towards the end of the season, and would just looked fairly imperious in midfield throughout the tournament. Looked absolutely superb in this way we analyse modern football now. I wonder whether he would have been that appreciated 10 years ago. I just think he was absolutely superb for Italy in controlling their games. He controlled the way they played. When you reflect on their performances throughout the tournament, apart from in patches here and there, they were the best and dominant team in every single game that they played, and they're worthy winners. And he was an absolutely phenomenal performer throughout.
Spinazzola. I know he missed the last two games with injury, but I've racked my brains trying to think someone who had more of an impact on their team and probably on the tournament. And I would say that despite his very, very sad injury against Belgium, Spinazzola, a left back, right footed left back who plays like a I don't know what kind of winger. He was outstanding. He was Italy's biggest threat. And he was a huge blow to lose him. And you could see actually in the celebrations, and you know, he was on someone's back, he was the first person up to kind of get his medal. You could see that the players and the staff and probably all of Italy appreciated how important he's been for them. So I would say Spinazzola.
Well, Italy's Gianluigi Donnarumma won it thanks to his penalty saves in the final and earlier on in the competition. But the only player that I think for me I felt wow watching in this tournament was Pogba at times. I wouldn't give him player of the tournament because obviously they didn't go deep into the competition. They drew three games. But I think for a period there, I was like, this guy's way too good to play for Man United. So he was just doing some special things. And I hope long may it continue. Hopefully we get to see the Paul Pogba that we've been talking about in terms of potential for so long. What about the breakthrough star of Euro 2020? Who did I start with before? Alison, was it you?
Oh, well, yes. Oh, dear. There's a bit of a theme developing here. It's Mikael Damsgaard, isn't it? I mean, no, he did.
Have you got any affinity to Denmark, Alison? I can't remember.
No, this is genuine, just a genuine stuff. No, but apart from the fact he did, he's young, 21, and he played really well and scored a particularly beautiful goal and, you know, has all the attributes of someone who I think will get better and better. He's the definition of a breakthrough star because he wasn't supposed to play. You know, he was a sort of sub for Christian Eriksen, really. He was a backup player. They weren't sure if he was mature enough. You know, didn't want to push him on the world stage too quickly. And he had to come in difficult circumstances and he broke through. And everyone now thinks, ooh, I want to see more of him. So I think that, again, is unarguable, although you seem to be arguing with me on my choices, which is very strange.
Shout out for Alex Isak for Sweden, who I think, despite, I don't even think he scored, but I just thought he looked like such a fascinating player with serious potential and an amazing touch in tight areas. But if Alisson's got a theme of picking Danish players, then my theme is picking Italians, Federico Chiesa. I don't know whether there's an age limit on breakthrough players, but lots of fans in Italy will say, we've known about this guy for a while, but I just thought he was superb through the tournament. And Gregor talks about them losing Spinazzola. I think he came in and then became their talismanic best player on a different flank. Berardi had started the tournament on the right. Chiesa then came on, scored some brilliant goals and quite rightly pushed his way to the front of the queue. I just thought he was superb. Such a different player. A bit of a throwback as well in the way that he played, kind of bustling, constantly looking to shoot all the time in this age of analysis and make sure your shot percentage chance is good and expected goals. He's just looking to kind of beat his man and get a shot away. He was fantastic to watch, full of joy. He's so joyful to watch.
He's improving rapidly, Chiesa, so expect big things from him because he had a lot of endeavour. He'd one of those players that would pick it up and run with it and not really know what he was doing with the ball at his feet and maybe overrun it or a defender would just get a toe end in. And now he seems like supremely in control of the ball and knowing exactly what he wants to do. Maybe that's having Ronaldo as a teammate helps you practice those things. But yeah, I expect to see more from him. Gregor, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it does seem odd going for somebody's Juventus player too, doesn't it? But it was like a pow. I've not really seen him that much of him, and he was
well. He's right. He didn't start the tournament in the 11.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And he's very different. But I'll go with someone else then. I think Joachim Mehl as well for Denmark fullback. He's been brilliant. And again, you know, he plays for Atalanta, although he only signed there in January from Genk. I wouldn't be surprised to see interest in him because he is a real force down the flank, and that assist, that cross to the outside of his right foot, that was probably the assist of the tournament. Probably won't have that category in this, will we? But he was outstanding as well. A little bit of a difficult game against England, but yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see interest in him.
Obviously, Pedri of Spain, sensational, 18 years old. He won the young player of the tournament and well-deserved as well. And another player we're going to see a lot of in the coming years. This is one that people have already argued with me several times on this podcast about. Best match at Euro 2020. Is there a definitive answer now, Tom? I'll start with you, seeing as Alisson's reading the paper again. Well, it's like she doesn't know it's coming. It's amazing.
I thought really, really hard about this one. The other ones were instinctive kind of answers, but I really thought hard about this. It was a fantastic tournament, I thought, but I really wanted to pick games that didn't finish on penalties. There were lots of brilliant games that finished on penalties. France-Switzerland obviously was a superb game, great drama, fantastic for the neutrals, but I decided not to pick that. So my honourable mention and shout-out goes to Holland-Ukraine, which I thought was the kind of first fun, slightly bonkers game in the group stages. And that was the kind of like, yes, it's that mad moments of watching tournament football where you get three games in a day and you come home from work and you stick the football on and bloody hell, it's 2-2. Oh, and they've won it. Denzel Dumfries becoming a household name for the first time. So that's my honourable mention. But I'm going to defer.
Just going to mention all the good games here.
only two. I've only done two so far, and then one more. That's all. I promise. I defer to my brother who watched as much of this tournament as me because I just said I can't pick, and he said Italy Belgium, great game end to end, great goals, fantastic drama, and 10 minutes at the end of Italy being absolutely vintage Italy. had everything, and it finished in 90 minutes. Perfect.
Hey, I mean, Tom said them all though, so
I've left you the best one. Scotland 0, England 0.
That was predictable, isn't it? I mean, that was my favourite. But I think Belgium Italy. I agree. There was great drama in the France Switzerland game, and the underdogs did well in this tournament, and that was the biggest shock. So that that deserves an honourable mention. But Belgium Italy had it all, and it was two top teams going right at it for most of the game. And until Italy just pulled out all the old tricks. And I think I read somewhere that they had the ball was in play for three of the final 12 minutes or something. It was mental. They just broke it up and killed it. And that's still part of football, and that's part of Italy, and that's part of how they won the competition.
Are you both bonkers? The obvious best game was Russia 1, Denmark 4. I know this to be true. I know this to be true because I was writing the match report, and if you're writing a report under tight pressure of a deadline where you're filing as the game goes on, it's actually quite hard to properly enjoy a match. But I was whooping away and having an absolute riot of a time while still being able to write about it. So it must have been amazing. It was also a game where all things were possible. So it went from, joy to tears to hope to what's happened in the other game. And you it's one of those games where people are cheering goals in the other game. And it was phenomenal. It was phenomenal. And it had wonder goals. And it made me think, wow, there's room for a fairy tale in this tournament as well. So, and it was also good for football because Denmark had in their previous game played incredibly well against Belgium, but got nothing out of it. And you sort of wanted them to be rewarded for the ability to do that. And they were. So it was just a stunning, exciting, all things possible, had everything. It had beauty as well as drama. What more can you want?
I personally liked Italy against Belgium as well, Gregor, but I really loved Spain-Italy semi-final too, from a tactical, technical point of view. I just, that was a game where the Italians basically got battered. I mean, they won the tournament in the end. But again, it was two different types of managers who were tactically incredible. On the day, Spain were absolutely fantastic, but Italy doing the other side of the game so well. And yes, they could have conceded more goals, and yes, they played really on the edge. That's what made it exciting. If Spain had a genuine center forward, I think they would have won the game comfortably. But then again, if Italy had a genuine center forward, they probably would have won the final 4-1, swings and roundabouts. But I thought from a pure football perspective, that semi-final was probably my favorite. Finally, your favorite goal. I mean, if anyone says Patrick Schick of the Czech Republic, look, it's obvious. He scored the goal of the tournament. It's obvious, but I want to know your favourite goal. Your favourite goal, Tom.
Well, it's full house. I mean, I definitely did say after the very first game that Italy were going to win it. My love in with Roberto and his jacket started, and I've been with them the whole way through. So it's a full house for Italy. Federico Chiesa's goal against Austria was just such a brilliantly simple but superb goal across to the back post, takes a touch, knocks it inside with the next touch, bang, hits it with the third. Looked incredibly simple. I said it at the time, it's one of those goals that as a fan you think, good goal, yeah, not bad, mate. And if you tried to do it, you'd have absolutely no chance. It'd bounce past you, you'd boot it up in the air. Superb technical ability, fantastic goal. And in a game, again, where Italy were just struggling a little bit, it was a brilliant goal. Full house for the Italians.
I mean, my favourite goal, old Callum McGregor. That's the only one time I got to celebrate in this tournament. I think my favourite goal was actually Pogba's against Switzerland. The way he made the yard of space. I think it was a little drag back and kind of then roll forward and sublime strike. He was, I think if France had gone a little bit further in the tournament, he would have been right in amongst the names for player of the tournament. He was outstanding, and that was a moment of absolute brilliance. So I think that was probably... There's a lot, though. Yarmolenko's... Sorry, I'm going to be Tom here. Just go through them all.
Get them all out there. It was a great tournament, lads. Come on, get them all out.
Yarmolenko's was an absolute cracker. Callum McGregor's, as I said. Pogba.
England scored some great goals as well. England scored a lot. If you go back and watch England's goals, they were great team goals. Great team, not against Ukraine, but the goals against Germany were great team goals. Even the goal against against Italy last night was a great team goal from back to front, through midfield, from one side to the other. They're the kind of goals that technically, in these days of analysis, you'd pore over for ages and ages. Scored some brilliant goals.
You should be very grateful that my favourite goal is Patrick Schick's goal, because he's not Danish, and that means I've diverted from my path. So, and I honestly, where are we coming from? We don't want to celebrate the obvious beautiful goal. It was extra beautiful because he'd planned it. He'd noted that there was, keeper comes quite off his line. I might try and take advantage of that. So to do it from over 50 yards away, absolutely incredible. So that is, that goal is imprinted now on my brain, and it's the goal. You said you can only watch one goal again. I'd watch that one again. So it's my favourite goal. Thank you.
I went for Karim Benzema's goal against Switzerland, where the ball gets played into him basically behind his run. He managed to flick the ball into the ground behind him and then just get onto it just before the keeper as he comes out and just dink it over him. Karim Benzema, what a goal. But that was a great game. That was maybe my favourite game. I don't know. But yeah, Tom, you're right. It went to pen, so it can't be up there. Cristiano Ronaldo got the golden boot. Just a quick mention for the old-timer still doing it at the top level, Cristiano. So just thought I'd mention that and say he's no longer the GOAT because Messi won the Copa America. But, you know, that's for a podcast on another day. Thank you so much for talking through all of that with me. It was quite difficult because of some of what happened yesterday and obviously losing the game. So hopefully we weren't too negative about it all, because it was a hopeful summer for English football and a great one to reach a final for the first time since 1966. So one to savour. We've hoped that you've enjoyed all of the Game Euro 2020 podcast as well. We'll be back in a few weeks. But Alison Rudd, Gregor Robertson, Tom Clark, thank you for being with me for the bumper now episode of the game, final episode of Euro 2020. And remember, if you're enjoying the podcast, leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcast from. And of course, make sure you're subscribed ahead of the new season to The Times and The Sunday Times for more of our great content. Just go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame. You can get it for less than £1 a day and begin your free trial right now. We will see you very soon.
Cue Dean Martin.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. When the world seems to shine like you've had too much wine, that's amore.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host Luke Jones for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.